Welcome to the House of Pod, a show where we pull back the curtain on the world of medicine, we answer questions about your health, and we interview great guests.
I'm Joe, and I'm not a doctor.
And I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Kaveh.
And we're two gastroenterologists.
What's a gastroenterologist?
You know, the doctors who work with your digestive system.
Say what?
You know, your liver, your pancreas, your intestines.
Where now?
Your butt, Joe. It's your butt.
Oh.
On today's show, we have Dr. Dara Kass. She's an ER doctor and the founder of Feminem. It's a group that advocates for women in medicine. Stay tuned.
Kaveh is wearing really tight underwear.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
Joe can't join us today. He's at a furries convention in Modesto. How you doing, Lizzie?
Modesto is far. I'm good. I would like to give a shout out to Joe in particular for all the work on the show and all the commuting. We're super grateful. But something I realized recently that I actually have changed my practice in medicine at work because of Joe.
Wow.
Like when I have patients who drink too much or smoke, you know, we talk about this with him, with Joe in particular, that I no longer just say, you know, stop, it's bad for you. I actually go into the details and I'll tell people explicitly, you know, I'm not saying to stop just because it's bad for you. I'm saying to stop because of the following concrete reasons why it's bad for you. Mm-hmm. So I actually use very different language. And it's interesting, you know, we talked to Raina Oddish about stuff like this, about trying to communicate and connect with patients in a different way. You know, don't just do your routine, try to see their perspective. And I really think Joe helped me on that. And I absolutely have changed the words that I use when I talk to people about changing their lifestyle.
Yeah, you know, okay, so if this is your first time listening to the show, we usually have another guy with us named Joe who is not a doctor. He's a friend of mine from like junior high, high school,
and now he's all friend. Of our friends. he's everyone's friend,
and he sort of gives us that perspective. I will tell you this too about Joe, just having basically grown up with him, I think it's a big part of the reason I'm able to communicate with patients as well as I do.
Because you spent years honing your Joseph communication skills?
Exactly. And, yeah. And you kind of joke about it.
No, I've seen it.
I have to translate...
to me.
Yeah, to you, what Joe is actually saying or what he actually thinks. And that has really helped me because now I think because of him, I always assume that no matter how smart someone is, no matter how educated they may be or how with it they seem to be in the course of our conversation, they may not get all the medical stuff because we are so trained to talk about things in a certain way because of all the education we got regarding it. It doesn't necessarily translate to other people and what they hear.
Right. And the one comment we get from everyone, including Dr. Raina Oddish after the show, was, you guys need more Joe.
I know.
And for our listeners, we do try to get him in a little bit. And we don't do a great job, but that is always a goal. That's another New Year's resolution, even though it's essentially the fall of 2019.
Yeah. Well, we miss him. We always miss him when he's not here.
So Kaveh, tell us about your Disneyland adventures or misadventures.
Yes. So I just got back essentially from Disneyland. It's like my second time going, by the way. Have you been to Disneyland?
I have once for a 3-year-old's birthday to celebrate my niece. And it's...
Did you go on any of the rides?
Anything suitable. Like there was one boat one. She was terrified.
The It's a Small World after all.
Is that with animals?
Yes, like it's a small. They sing the same song for like 30 minutes.
No, I don't think so. This was like a safari thing. Okay. We were all only there. Yeah. It was a princess themed weekend adventure.
Got you. A lot like the one I had, but
without the princesses, without the actresses.
So, if the listeners have been to Disneyland, I think you'll know what I'm talking about. But it is fucking terrifying. These rides are supposed to be like kid friendly. They are dark. Like we went, they all like follow this weird formula, right? Which is like where you go into this ride, you strap in, you go into like a dark sort of building. It starts off kind of nice. And then it gets weird, and the main character or the person goes through some experience, and there's this weird like 60s morality thing where they get judged for it, and then they get sent to like some version of hell, mm-hmm. and then they come out of it okay. Like we're like, okay, let's take the kids on Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. Sounds really simple. It's crazy. I thought I was like on LSD.
I was going to say, this all sounds like a bad trip and a little bit of a Charlie and the Chocolate Fetch, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate, and there's no sign of slowing with Gene Wilder's right. like creepy right. intense.
It's this really weird 60s yeah. thing that they got going on. And that's what it was like the whole time. Like you start off on this Mr. Toad's Wild Ride and he's going for a friendly jump through a romp through the streets of London or something. And then he like starts careening recklessly through the streets. He gets sentenced by a barrister to jail, but it's not jail, it's hell. There's like guys with pitchforks and fire, and my kids were like, what is going on?
Right. Why is it so dark? How do you explain that to your 2.5 and your 5.5 year old?
They were like, they came out of that, they were shook.
They were like, again.
No, everyone was like, my wife and I looked at each other, we're like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah.
And then all the rides, like, there's a Winnie the Pooh ride and he takes some like bad honey, and there's the Pirates honey. Of the Caribbean, which is also like crazy.
Yeah. Even though it was a bad trip, your kids, I'm sure, liked it and want more.
They're okay. I think I actually probably had the most fun because they had like that Star Wars thing and it was awesome. It's like they recreated like Tatooine, the planet that Luke Skywalker's from.
Sure.
You're looking at me like you don't know any of these words that are coming out of my mouth.
I just don't want it known that I don't know anything about Star Wars because my nieces really like them a lot. So I pretend that I know a little bit, but it's all a charade, if you will.
Charade. It's awesome. Yeah. Like, I got issues with Disney. I can go into that at some other point. But if for nothing else, you got to just appreciate the sheer scale of which they do these things. It is impressive. It is massive. I did see some things that were kind of weird. Like, because we live in sort of a little bubble here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the way people look. And I saw people from other parts of the country there. They get heavier than other parts of this country. And a lot of them use Rascals. You know what Rascals are?
I didn't until you told me a couple of days ago.
Yeah, those adult like mobility scooters.
Is that a brand, I guess? Because otherwise,
I think it's a band.
I would say a mobilized wheelchair, motorized wheelchair, right?
It's not a wheelchair, though. It's like, because they can get on and off.
Oh, like a scooter.
These are people who can walk, I think, like short distances, but they have something wrong that keeps them from like being able to walk. There was a lot of like somebody being pushed around in a wheelchair and then seeing something they wanted and getting up and running from the wheelchair. And I'm sure there's a good reason for why they were able to do that and why mm-hmm. they were in a wheelchair. It just, the optics of it didn't look good, that you're being pushed around and then you're like, oh, I'm so excited. You run out and you see something and then you do it and then you jump back into your wheelchair.
So the two things about Disneyland is what you're saying with the Rascals. They're genius at marketing. So my guess is as soon as you walk into the park, you can get a Rascal for $20, $50, $100, $1 million a day. And they're just so smart in that way, marketing everything. These kids are just like a bit brainwashed. But again, they're doing a really good job. That's, you know, capitalism. And the other thing is, honestly, they deserve some of it because the customer service there was outstanding.
At Disneyland. Yeah. We're giving them a lot of buzz marketing. They are not promoting this, what you're saying.
I also think there's something very sinister to the rides that you're describing and to the brainwashing component of the marketing. And, you know, the kids are a bit addicted. Like, your kids are going to ask over and over. But we were in line waiting to see one of the many, many princesses we met at Disneyland. And I think my niece had to pee or was just a bit sort of crying, a little meltdown. Just cut the line. Like, the people there were just very attentive and in tune with what like the customer needed and what was quote unquote fair, right? Mm. Like, there's a balance between having a kid screaming and ruining everybody's 15, 20 minutes in line, or letting her cut the line and making everybody happy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
they were just really good at that. So I do.
No, they were great. I mean, the people that worked there were all great. It was, I mean, we could talk about my overall like feeling that their movies are a little bit racist, particularly in the past, but
oh,
that's
my God.
A different thing.
Let's talk about A Little Mermaid. It's a character where the woman has to woo a man with no language.
Yeah.
So she really has to seduce him mm-hmm. with her body.
Feminine wiles. Can I tell you a fun fact about that story?
Yeah.
You know how the original story, like when it was written, like the Grimms, when they wrote it, do you know how it went?
I'm pretty sure the answer is bloody fucking murder.
Yeah, pretty much. Her this is okay.
All the originals.
They're all so dark. Like she loses her voice in the cartoon because she makes this deal with Ursula, the sea witch.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, in the ride is also terrifying.
Sure.
And she loses her voice in the book or the short story, which it comes from. It's because she cuts out her tongue.
Oh, I did not know that.
You know how it ends? It ends with a little mermaid.
Wait, bloody murder.
Close. Desiccated on the beach.
Oh.
Like that she dies. I don't think
she dies.
It's bad.
It's not good. It's bad.
It's not good. Oh, if you have Disneyland thoughts too, please share them with us. You can do that at our email, hopquestions@gmail.com. You can call us 408-444-6623. Follow us on Facebook and also find us on Instagram and most importantly at Twitter at the House of Pod. Before we go to our guest, did you like that segue, by the way? That wasn't bad, was it?
That was very good.
Before we go to our next guest.
I was thinking we wouldn't have to edit anything, but now we might.
No, this stays in.
Because you just patted yourself on the shoulder.
Listen, someone's got to give me credit.
Yeah.
Okay, so thanks for Joe Nadim for production. All music editing is all done by us here at the House of Pod. Stay tuned for our next guest. We have Dr. Dara Kass. She's going to be part two of our series, Women in Medicine. Stay tuned. Okay, we are here with Dara Kass, ER physician and the founder of Feminine. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We know you're busy. Well, will you tell us what Feminine stands for, like literally and also, you know, figuratively, I guess?
Sure. So it technically came from the combination of the words femme or female in emergency medicine. And we were looking for the name of an organization for women in emergency medicine that felt like a new brand, right? We came at it from the perspective of if we were going to create a community and a movement, what would we call it? And Feminine kind of rolls off your tongue. It feels very like, you know, branded and easy, and there's a lot of ways integrated into other things. The funny story is after we were like, oh, yes, it's going to be Feminine. It's a website, so we need Feminine.com. We went to buy the domain name for Feminine.com, and somebody that really hates Eminem, the rapper, owned it. Feminine, as in F Eminem.
I thought it was to make him like feminize him a little bit,
no.
Which in hip hop culture is not cool.
Or like a cover artist, someone who did like only covers, but it was like a woman who did covers of Eminem songs.
Right. Feminine version.
Right.
So anyway, I tried to buy it from that person, and I was like, ooh. So how much would it be? It's not for sale.
You know what?
And then I hate him too much. I'll never give it up.
And then did you say,
I need it.
Tell me your number. Everything's for
sale. No, I did, and they said no.
Wow.
It's about owning. I was like, you know what? You can have it. And we became Feminine.org and solved their own problem. So it's all good.
Yeah. That's a passionate anti-Eminem person. You don't
really
meet those.
Hate them.
Yeah, exactly.
So what Feminine is a place where we discuss and solve problems affecting women in emergency medicine, which is really applicable to women in almost any specialty, and actually a lot of men, or kind of not just women in medicine.
So speaking of which, what are the problems that are specific for women in medicine, and then maybe specifically emergency medicine?
So I think that, you know, every brand of medicine has its own specialty thing. So emergency medicine has a lot of really amazing qualities, and then some that are difficult for, you know, women specifically. A lot of times, like, the schedule can be really complicated because it's not a 9-to-5 job. And as your life changes and your needs change, you know, we find it difficult to schedule around an erratic schedule. Right. Let's say that you're having to do childcare, or let's say that your parents are sick. Women are generally the care providers in their families, even if they aren't married with children. That's one thing. The biases we see in medicine across the board, whether it's for promotion or it's for leadership roles or it's for salary, those are all applicable in any specialty. So those are things that we address a lot. One of the things that we noticed as a problem and then addressed was the lack of women speakers at conferences. So that came up really early as a conversation topic. And we did a Google Hangout then, which would have been a podcast, but we didn't have podcasts yet, with somebody who was a conference organizer who had no women speakers at his conference. And he got called out in a harsh way on Twitter. And he was a really good champion of women, you know, in general. So people were like shocked. And like, if he's going to do this, you know, kind of all men fail, you know, and we use it as a chance to have a conversation. And so we had this conversation with him. We videoed it. We put it out there. And he said a few things that I really heard and resonated with me in that conversation, which were, as a conference organizer, he wanted to really have high-level speakers. And he had asked all the really high-level speaker women that he knew, but none of them could do it. And he had taken chances on male speakers before that were not of his level, and they had disappointed him. So he realized he only could go to people that he had heard before and that he believed in. And he basically ran out of names. And he didn't mean for it to happen.
He never heard a woman before.
Well, he had heard some. He had a couple.
But not enough.
Right?
Yeah.
Not enough, right? Yeah. So I was like, well, I know a lot of women, right? I have binders full of women. That's like what I say when I give this lecture. And I'm like,
it's a little Mitt Romney. It's nice.
Right. Binders full of women. Ode to Mitt. Now, right? So I said, you know, how can he hear and see all the women that I know? Right. I'm not going to give him names. And the other thing about FemineM is it's a sustainable space where not everybody has to ask me for advice anymore, right? So I don't want to be the one giving all the names of women speakers, because that also creates a bias. If I don't know you, then that's a problem too. Right. So we created the first speakers bureau for women in medicine in, you know, at FemineM, that was open access, free to the end user, and had video and audio of the person speaking. And I mean, now it has like 400 women speakers, I think. Yeah. And other groups have replicated that. And that's the thing about what we do, is none of what we do is rocket science, but it is pretty effective. And so the minute that somebody else wants to use something similar, I kind of think it's great.
It's so interesting because it's just such a cultural shift now, right? It's not about the 1970s women lib movement, you know, and before that women's voting rights and, you know, 50 years before that. It's really about not just saying it, it's acting, right? And it's like walking the walk. And now Emily's List for female political candidates is something that's really very prevalent in social media and the world. And we see, I've read an article recently on women headlining music festivals. There's not enough of that. And you also have to champion that because, you know, it's like the concept of affirmative action. You need people to be given an opportunity preferentially because they've never been given an opportunity before. And it sounds like that's what you guys are doing for women, at least for speakers.
Right. So I think that, you know, it's funny because a lot of times we give a lot of these lectures on like gender bias and promotion and, you know, quotas and tokens and all these things that people use because they're like, well, why would I not just promote the best candidate? Why do I have to promote a woman or a person of color or somebody in the LGBT community? Like, why would I care? Right. I want just the best person.
Right.
And we realize that, you know, I like to like have these mind games, you know, like go into a room and imagine that everybody in the room, instead of being white, is black. Or imagine that all the people, instead of being men, are women, and realize that we live in a structure that, you know, expects a white male to be in charge. It expects a white man to be on stage. And so our conscience and our semi-conscious and our, you know, unconscious are all just like expecting that best person to be a white guy.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that we're failing as, you know, critical thinkers. It's that's how we're built. Yeah, so it's not about creating an uneven playing field for the advantage of those who identify as either women or minorities or any other kind of underrepresented group. It's about leveling the playing field against the biases they face ahead of time. And remember that those biases exist from like basically the day you're born, right? So it's not just about how you are promoted in medical school, but it's about how you get into medical school or how you get, you know, scored and treated before you take the test.
Yeah.
And so I think that when we kind of bring it out to that larger spectrum of conversation, we realize that these are actions towards equality. They're not actions towards an uneven advantage.
Right.
So what kind of pushback have you gotten, both online, spending time in sort of the Twitterverse, and in academically, professionally?
So I think that, you know, the most common thing is for people, and I say this with the most love in my heart, who sit pretty in a white male patriarchy. And I say use those terms because it's not only white men, or it's not only men that do this. There's a lot of people that have figured out a system that works for them in the current hierarchy, mm-hmm. and they are kind of scared of changing that system, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of people that don't want to believe or don't believe that the pay gap is real, right? They are convinced that it is, you know, about choices that women make, and they don't accept that the structural limits put on women's careers by bias or the unavailability of childcare or the expectations that, you know, the social expectations that they're raised under, those things affect their careers. And so a lot of people put their N of one perspective into the conversations. Mm-hmm. So they'll be like, well, I know that my wife makes as much money as I do, so there's no pay gap in medicine. And we're all like, yeah, that's great for your wife. But let's be honest, she's still probably underpaid by about 10% to her male colleagues. She just may be making the same amount of money as you. Right. And so I think that those are the big pushback we get is from naysayers who really just can't or won't believe that this system is not set up to be fair, because they need to believe that they have worked as hard as they can to get everything that they deserve, and that everybody else who doesn't have what they have, it's got to be their fault, because if there are inherent systemic advantages to them, then somehow they didn't earn as much.
Well, that's like, it's, yeah, sorry. That's the concept of the narrative, right? Creating a narrative, right, to get the end result that you think is true, or it is your reality, you have to go back and sort of change things around a little bit, you know?
And it's not a judgment on them. The thing that's interesting to me, and I think when you do kind of this work anywhere, at least for me, is it's not about me. I'm fine. You know, I'm doing great, you know, like I'm happy. So I don't take it personally. Even when somebody like rages about women and feminism and angry feminism and, you know, horrible men who should be wearing bras themselves, because why would a man identify as a feminist, and all these things that they say. And I'm like, dude, like, you got, it's your problem, not mine. I'm happy to talk to you when you're ready to talk to me. But, you know, I think that how I deal with it is I don't personalize it. You know, it's, mm-hmm. this isn't about me personally. This is about the system and what needs to change.
Yeah. And then, we've talked, we are trying to give voices to women in medicine and women in leadership specifically, or people who want to sort of shake it up a little bit. And the question really was, how do you make it so that women don't have a binary decision about sort of motherhood or career without this penalty of respect equality and pay equality and all those things that you just said about women making choices and they have to suffer the consequences, where that's not actually the truth?
I mean, the answer is easy. You promote a culture by which men don't have to make the choice either, right? I mean, to me, that's always been the first principle, is we have created a culture by which both genders choose, only they are forced to make the different choices by both biology and culture, right? And so the solution for many women in medicine, like I would say, like in the generation right before us, has been to have partners that flip gender roles, right? So they have stay-at-home partners and they are physicians and working full-time. And so the answer to this is stop making people make choices that have to do with being partially human or entirely working. Like, that entire culture needs to go away, because, you know, when I have this conversation and I frame it around paternity leave, like, what is the best way to stop penalizing women for taking maternity leave, a biologically, physiologically, and actually legally required entity, it's to promote men taking paternity leave.
Yeah.
Right? Because the salary gaps we face as women would be neutralized if our male colleagues took the same leave we did, at least those that are related to the unpaid leave of absence that is maternity leave.
Yeah.
It also would not have that same social stigma. You wouldn't be passed over for promotion. You wouldn't be viewed as a lesser than employee. Yeah. If our male colleagues also took their kids to the doctor, right? It is just common sense that we need to create a culture that allows all of our physicians, all of our nurses, all of our colleagues to be human and to be engaged in their own lives, and stop forcing women to be the only ones that have to do it.
Yeah. I have a lot of friends who 7 to 10 years ago, when everybody was sort of interviewing for jobs, definitely were explicitly asked the question, do you think you're going to get pregnant, become pregnant in the next few months or year? you know, and that really helped determine whether or not they would get the job. And yet, if this is the perfect person for this job, what difference does it make if you want to take 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months maternity leave? Because, you know, hiring a good colleague is one of the most important things that we can do, you know?
We spend a lot of time being very, very short-sighted. This is true, actually, in politics. It's true in government and in organizations. You know, we are very short-sighted managers. And we look at new employees, specifically young physicians just coming out of residency who are 30 years old. And we say, oh, my God, you're already going to be a liability before you're going to be an advantage. Right. And that's biologically the time that women generally have children. But men can push that off biologically. And that creates, again, an unfair advantage for men in that moment. And so I think that if we look larger at our employees and our investments, right, because physicians as employees, as partners, are investments. And I was having this conversation with a mentee of mine who's a faculty member who's a non-birth mother. So she's married to another woman. And so her wife had the baby. And we're talking about her baby is 6 months old, and we're talking about, you know, her re-entree into academic medicine. And she took a little bit of, I mean, 6 months is, you know, that's how much time it took her family to kind of, you know, get it together with this baby. I mean, babies rock your world. And she's already talking about all the exciting opportunities for her academically that she couldn't have had that conversation 2 months ago.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm like, you're back. And she's like, I am back. And I was like, see, you were worth waiting for. And she's like, yes, I was. And I think that it's so important that we remember these are such short-term problems for such long-term gains for all of our employees. And it's much better that we invest in them and that we keep them around for that period of time.
Yeah.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about sexual harassment in medicine.
Oh, I didn't know where that was going.
Yeah.
Harassment came a little delayed in my audio. Oh,
you just heard sexual? Let's just talk about the chemistry here. But talking about sexual harassment in medicine, and everyone I think is familiar with the hashtag Time's Up, but tell us a little bit about Time's Up healthcare and how this sort of plays into the bigger overall picture in the country.
First of all, I think that one of the things we can reframe is sexual harassment versus gender-based harassment that comes in multiple forms. And so, you know, kind of sexual coercion, sexual, you know, being forced in sexual acts, and also being, the language is escaping right now, but being in environments that are verbally abusive, but don't actually rise to the level of true sexual harassment. So there's all these layers that happens. So Time's Up grew out of a action-based movement from what happened basically 2 years ago with Me Too, right? So hashtag Me Too started first with women sharing their stories about harassment that had happened in their lives, and finally kind of busting out of the quiet zone and talking about what had happened to them. Time's Up was really the action of that, which was what do we do next? How do we answer these calls and say, with these women, how do we stand together for a culture that's safe, dignified for women everywhere? And Time's Up was formed actually when a few women in Hollywood started speaking about their experiences, and they started a nonprofit legal defense fund that was the largest GoFundMe ever in the history of GoFundMe. It was $23 million funded to help women, specifically low-income women, bring harassment claims in their lives, mostly in the workplace. And so after Time's Up Global was founded, you know, as the project grew, they said, let's go to industry-specific spaces and let's address this issue in industries if it's an employment-based, you know, situation. And so they started with entertainment, which was where they had really started. And then there was tech and advertising, and then, of course, healthcare. And so when healthcare started, it was a cohort of us that had been doing a lot of this gender-based work. So I had done Feminem, and then Esther Chu, you know, had started a company called Equity Quotient. And she's, in my opinion, one of the foremost experts in our field in this space. And then a few other women that we had known together that were all doing work like this. And we came together to form Time's Up Healthcare that is about creating a safe, dignified, and equitable workplace in healthcare. And it applies to all elements of healthcare. So it's not just for physicians. It's not just for nurses. It's for anybody that interacts in the healthcare space. So one of the more surprising groups of women that have been harassed regularly once we started talking about this was actually drug reps. right? So they come into physicians' offices. They're almost all women. They're almost all told, like waitresses, that your trade is your look and that you must get in the door at any cost. And these physicians, mostly men, mostly older men, who are, you know, in specialties where they have been told that their power is, you know, their purse or their pocket, whatever it is, have made these women do things that are not just inappropriate, but horrific to get the business that they need to survive.
Because they work on like commission mostly.
Right.
Right. And we know.
So it could be.
We know. Yeah. I mean, just as doctors or as GI doctors, like we saw so many drug reps in the, not recently, I haven't seen them in a long time, but they're always young. They're, I've seen obviously men as well, men and women, and they're often like very well put together, often very attractive, you know, very charming. And clearly that's part of the gimmick, you know?
But that's the point, right? They're told that they have to do this to get in the door to do their job, and they get paid well to do this job. And yet they're trained in the drug. They're trained with knowledge. They're trained to educate. And yet they're treated sometimes so inappropriately in that space. And I mean, I remember like thong Thursdays, that in order to get into the office on Thursday, you have to show me a thong.
Oh, nice.
I mean, that's amazing, right? We've seen so many stories of attendings and, you know, who have coerced and harassed residents and medical students and, you know, nurses everywhere, home health aides, you know, customers or clients in their homes, forcing their home health aides to watch porn with them. Anyway, so the stories could overwhelm you. But the good part is that now that we're together, we get to start these initiatives. So some of the initiatives we're starting are things like having signatory organizations that come together to stand up for safe and equitable and dignified work. Working on making sure that, you know, boards of organizations or editorial boards of journals or, you know, panels of No More Mannels, right? These are things we're going to do as time goes on to increase the presence of women across all of healthcare and address these inequities using that platform that we get in partnership with Time's Up. But our goal is not to address this on an individualized level. It's much more about creating systemic change. Sometimes we are fortunate enough to have the platform to highlight huge egregious cases. So there was obviously those cases that are currently being litigated and highlighted in the news that are at many of our institutions, or there's a big lawsuit at Mount Sinai right now that's been all over the news. And so on both gender and age-based harassment. And so a lot of times we'll kind of amplify those efforts, but they're going through their own legal cases with their own representation. And we're just here to be available for systemic change as it comes along.
Specifically in regards to doctors, where do you feel the sexual harassment is the biggest problem? Is it in medical school? Is it during internship, residency? Where?
So it's in medical school. So half of all medical students have all female medical students have been victimized for have been victims of one form of gender based or sexual harassment, whether it's just you know, conversations or, you know, actual coercion or actual sexual assault. And there's a report out from the National Academies of Science in Engineering and Medicine that describe this. It gets more pervasive and I think more profound as you go up in the hierarchy. But it is everywhere actually. So, I think that if you go into more male-dominated specialties, you may see it more, but I don't know the data on that particularly. Mm-hmm. What I can tell you is it's everywhere, and we're all, therefore, we all have to be part of the solution.
You know, we've also talked about people, and ourselves included, who have had roles of not just doctors and advocates, an advocate not politically, but an advocate for your own family and your own healthcare. So will you tell us a little bit about, you know, your son's story of he needed a liver transplant and you were a living donor, which for our listeners means you are obviously here with us today. Thank goodness. alive and healthy.
Some liver left.
Right. Yeah. The most common type of liver transplant that, you know, Kaveh and I are also liver docs that we help arrange a lot are, cadavers from people who've just died. But more and more you'll see a living donor. So that means you were able to give your son part of your liver. So will you tell us a little bit about that?
So I will say that I solve problems for a living, and sometimes I do it in my house as well. So unfortunately, so I have three kids, and my third child was born with alpha 1 antitrypsin deficiency. And the reason why that's important is actually it's an inherited disease. So we didn't know we carried it. And my husband and I, he was a small for gestational age baby. So he was tiny, tinier than my other kids. And when we found out that he had alpha 1, we realized that we had done this. It was our fault, right? Aww. So we were like, oh man, we got to fix this too. And so he inherited a recessive gene from my husband and from myself. And when he was two months old, we found that he had alpha 1 and he was having a scarred liver. We didn't know what was going to happen. Most people that have alpha 1, you guys are liver doctors, know, will grow out of the liver fibrosis, the scarring of the liver. They learn how to, their body is able to fix it. I'm just going to keep it simple, right? So, however, in a small percentage of patients, they can't, and they go to full-blown cirrhosis, right? Liver failure, fibrotic liver, and you track it by ultrasound. So we knew by a year old that he was on the path to no victory and that he was going to need a transplant. And I was in the ER with him at Columbia, which is where I work now, but I didn't then, and he was getting a tap, like a little itty-bitty, you know, paracentesis, a little bit of fluid out of his belly with a little butterfly needle. I had never seen it done with such a little needle, right? Oh. And the doctor says to me, he had a fever, right? So, but he was fine. He didn't have any infection there. And the doctor says to me, hey, we're going to go to transplant, and would you be the donor? And I was like, totally, of course I'll do it. And the reason was, as an emergency medicine doctor, I had seen the other side, right? So often of patients that had gone to end-stage disease waiting for an organ, I knew that from a system perspective, all the things he didn't have yet as his liver was going to fail, you know, GI bleeding and, mm-hmm. and encephalopathy and all these things I had imagined him having on the way to transplant, mm-hmm. I could prevent by just laying down and going to sleep, right? And so I
yeah,
said,
maybe a little bit more than that, but yeah.
No, bit. I mean, but that's it, right? To me, it was like about the idea that here's a solution right in front of us. It is cheaper for the system. It is safer for my child. It's arguably a little bit less safe for me, but heck, I'm a mom.
And so a little bit less safe?
Yeah, I'm like, it's not arguably less safe. It's 1,000%.
Right, but I know that the truth is that on all the spectrum of my family's combined health and wellness, it seemed like an on-whole right. better choice.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, the other thing about it they don't talk about is, like, you know, living organ transplants occur on a Tuesday at 9 a.m., mm-hmm. right? So your doctor is well-rested. You have the best anesthesiologist, you know? You know that you're getting first, like, dibs at the OR. Again, for me, what?
You're saying as opposed to a middle of the night motorcycle right. accident where all the organs are harvested, a helicopter comes and everything is an emergency.
And the other part of it is that as a doctor and as somebody that declared, you know, people brain dead not infrequently, it was kind of nice to think that nobody had to die.
Yeah.
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 The other part, just so you know, from a fun medical, you know, facts perspective is that living donors, parents to children, do really, really well on immunosuppressive medications. And a lot of these kids actually come off of meds entirely, oh, wow. which is a huge gift on top of a gift mm-hmm. because you are, if you can be off meds and be transplanted, it's a lot of observation, but the risk is really mitigated a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. There is some thought that at that point, it sort of becomes your own. The organ sort of becomes mm-hmm. your own. And for our listeners who aren't that familiar with how the liver works, essentially, it's a rare organ in that it can regrow. And so you can take a part of it and then part of it can regrow and give you plenty of liver.
Sammy's liver is entirely in the wrong place. So his liver is actually right smack in the middle of his body. Mm-hmm. So he has to, when he goes to get examined, you know, you have to tell people, like, you're going to look at it in the totally wrong place because it's not exactly where it's supposed to be normally. Mm-hmm. But I can drink again, thank God, because I am an emergency medicine doctor.
Which is the most important thing.
But, you know, you have to make sure that you can have a glass of wine after some of our shifts. And thank God he's really fine. You know, it's a miracle. I mean, and again, as an advocate, one of the things that's really important to us is we talk about this a lot because, you know, medicine is really scary for lots of people. And I wrote an article for the New York Times about the transplant about 6 months afterwards. Esther Chu, actually, all good things in my life come from ideas in her head. And I needed to do something. And she was like, well, why don't you write about the transplant? And I wrote an article for the New York Times on the process of donating, but literally the actual mechanical process, like, how does the liver get from me to him? Well, it turns out they walk it down a sky bridge in the hospital. And my husband was like, can I get Secret Service to walk with them? Because that's a pretty valuable walk. And so people don't even know, like, how does that happen from one to the other? We both went to bed. We needed to have child care for him and care for me. Yeah. There's a lot of pieces to the logistics that are scary to people that they may not be scared of if they knew about it. So we do a lot of this, kind of speaking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many logistical things I would have questions about. Like, how did you start taking care of your family at some point while you're recovering from a surgery like that?
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, when I think about our fortune, right, single parents, specifically single mothers with multiple children who have the opportunity to do this, don't always do it. Because if I had other children to take care of, I may not be able to do it. It's also less common for parents to donate to children less than a year old if they are, because of the same thing, like the cumbersome aspect. I couldn't lift him for a good month.
Right.
And I definitely couldn't be the primary caregiver. And so you realize from a village perspective how lucky we are to have that village to help take care of us and let this be his life-saving procedure.
Yeah. Well, thank you for telling us about that. And you said people, you know, you wrote that New York Times article that we'll post or at least read. I didn't know about that, but you know, people don't know about medicine. And again, that's what we try to do. So thank you for coming on and telling us about your advocacy for women in emergency medicine and about your son's story. So thank you so much.
Hey, where can we send people to learn more about what Feminem does and any other thing you want to plug?
So the feminem.org is the website. We kept it even after, you know, I think the FMNM guy went away. Mm-hmm. And then we actually, one of the things that grew out of the FMNM was this conference. So we actually have an in-person conference every year. It's amazing. It's kind of like TED Med meets Makers meets all kinds of cool stuff. Next year, it'll be in Chicago, September of 2020. It is the coolest medical conference out there, I will tell you. It's pretty amazing. And it's about gender equity. It's about gender in medicine, but it's really about what it is to be a human in medicine. And we have some of the most amazing talks. And then, on Twitter at Sarah Cass, timesuphealthcare.org. And then any other place, I feel like you could put me into Google and you'll find me.
Do men come to the conference?
Yes. They speak. We have, about 10% of our attendees are men, maybe 5. And the ones that come are changed forever. Because you don't realize sometimes how male-centric your life is, especially in medicine, until you walk into a room of all women in medicine, and it's not about breastfeeding.
Right. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you guys for having me. This was really fun.
Thank you.
Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo.
So what's a scenario? Yo. Bonos is what?
Boom, 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 boom. Boom, boom, boom.
The opinions on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns. All anecdotes and patient-related details have been changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible. And now